Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea. Featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very, very pleased to be sitting opposite Dr. Gerald Mast, professor of political science at Carthage College, a frequent guest to the morning show, and we have a lot to talk about today. We are going to basically focus our attention today on the Democrats, a still crowded field of Democrats who are contending to be their party's nominee for president for the fall of 2018 to confront incumbent President Donald Trump. And it has already been a fascinating race, and we're going to be looking at what has transpired thus far in Iowa, Nevada, New Hampshire, and what is coming up in the near future, including Super Tuesday in early March, and how all of this could potentially play out. Of course, there's no way to know for certain, but what is the road ahead for Bernie Sanders, the current front runner? What are the prospects of Joe Biden catching up? What about some of the other big contenders who at the moment seem to be faltering? Is Michael Bloomberg a factor? If so, what? And depending on how these various contenders do, then how are things shaping up to culminate at the party's convention right up the road in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, later this year? It's an incredibly interesting and, of course, important story. And Gerald Mast is going to make sense of all of it. Professor Gerald Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thanks for setting the bar real high, Gregory.
Real quick, I think I've said this to you before, but I have to say it again. It just seems like we are in a moment that is a political science professor's dream in terms of the way really critical issues and events are playing out. And it just seems like a smorgasbord of fascinating material for you to be discussing and dissecting with your political science students at Carthage.
Yeah, there's certainly ample things to discuss and talk about. It can be a little overwhelming at times, even for a political scientist. It's easy to become sucked into the subject to an unhealthy degree. So I will just encourage my fellow citizens, when you feel a bit overwhelmed, it's okay to step back and stop paying super close attention.
Right. So It's been kind of an amazing race thus far, in particular because it has been such a crowded field, I mean, in the early going. Yeah. And I suspect that this is unprecedented, that in a presidential race we have never had so many significant contenders hang in there for quite so long. Am I right?
Yeah. In recent history, the field winnows down relatively quickly. Some races aren't remotely in question. In 2000, Al Gore was battling with Bill Bradley. Battling's probably not the right word because Gore won every single state contest. The race in 2004 featured John Kerry battling with Wesley Clark and John Edwards. That race settled really quickly, Kerry winning all of them except for, I think, four states he failed to capture. In 1988, Michael Dukakis won the nomination and outlasted Dick Gephardt and Gary Hart. They fell out real quickly. Jesse Jackson hung around all the way till the convention, never really posed a serious threat to Mr. Dukakis, and yet did function, I think, to kind of energize a debate within the party about the party's character and direction and so forth. And so if we can think about the nomination process, there's a couple of kind of things going on there. One is to identify who's the nominee, individual who's going to represent the party in the general election. But there's also an opportunity within this overall nomination process for ideas to be debated and contested, and a kind of general sense of where the party's identity should be. And so every process is about picking the nominee. And in some years, the debate over the identity and direction of the party is muted and mild, and there's really not a lot of debate.
Not right now.
And this year, of course, not only is the field very large with respect to the numbers of people still contending for the that first function of the nomination process, we have a raging debate over the identity of the party and the character of it.
We have a process that has come under a lot of scrutiny and under a lot of criticism, that in terms of which primaries and caucuses are first,
yes,
and then
yes,
sort of the pacing of what happens from this point on. Do you share some of those concerns that this process is not set up in a way that is ultimately maybe beneficial to the party and or the American people?
Yes, for sure. And I think that one of the consequences that I would predict will come of this season is that the Democratic National Committee will sit down and have a long, difficult, and thoughtful assessment of how the process played out and what are those problems and what should it do different. And I think that at the top of the list will be the calendar. Who gets to go first? How are they going to arrange that? And that'll be a hard conversation and a very difficult task if, in fact, they do shake up the calendar. But I think the most trenchant criticisms of the process as it is currently are that you have a handful of states that have been kind of granted this privilege of going first: Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. These are states that get to weigh in first, and in the process of weighing in first, they create momentum, they shape perception, and that has this huge impact on this massive day that's coming right down the pike, a Super Tuesday on March 3rd. And so so to this point, we've had four contests, or we will have had four contests once Saturday's primary in South Carolina completes. The total number of delegates allocated in those four contests is something like 155, if I did my math right. A week later, right, Super Tuesday, there will be 16 contests, 14 states, a territory, and Democrats abroad. Will go, right? That's four times as many contests as has happened to this point. And more than a third of the delegates that will be allocated in the whole process will be allocated on that single day.
On that single day.
And so it's hugely important. And the contests that have come so far have kind of created this narrative, created a kind of order, a front runner. Mr. Sanders is currently the front runner, which will impact the voting that occurs on Super Tuesday. And so there are real reasonable questions about the fairness of kind of granting or conferring privilege on this handful of states that will have this kind of big impact, especially for states, two of them, Nevada and Iowa, run caucuses rather than primaries. And the difference, of course, in a caucus, the key difference is that in a caucus, you'll get much lower turnout. Fewer people will go because of the enormous time commitment
you don't just
go and cast a ballot and go home.
You stand sometimes for hours
right,
at a time.
And correct. And so to the extent that one can make the argument that caucuses are not particularly representative of the populations within the state, right, that amplifies the anger or consternation that many Democrats have that states like Iowa and Nevada already have a kind of disproportionate amount of influence.
Right. And I should think it also feels so strange for the candidates when you think about how the candidates descended on Iowa and spent so much time there. I mean, going to every little county fair and
right,
visiting all these little hamlets. And then at some point, the nature of the race changes completely. And there is no time to do any of that sort of
right,
things in these 14 states on Super Tuesday, for instance. I mean, it's an absolute impossibility, and they have to wage the battle at that point in a completely different way.
It really does. And this is actually an argument for Iowa and the caucuses. It requires candidates for the White House to actually interface with people, right? To shake some hands, to put some hands on shoulders, to listen to, you know, real ordinary folks' problems. And it creates a kind of connection between the people who want to become president of the United States and at least some real people in the United States. And so, I mean, and that's, I think, just my personal view, is a compelling argument in favor of a process like Iowa's. But you're absolutely right that the nature of running is going to change really, really quickly. And so when you look at candidate, and because the candidates put so much energy and resources and effort into these early states, you wind up with some candidates who have done, you know, okay to this point, finding themselves in dire trouble because they lack the funds to compete across the country all at the same time in 12 or 14 different states at once, in which, you know, big media markets are going to require serious investments and so forth. So a candidate like Amy Klobuchar, for instance, has done, you know, reasonably well in a number of ways, is low on money in relative to some of her candidates, fellow candidates. And so her prospects moving forward have to change in a variety of ways, one of which is all of a sudden she's going to have to start pulling in money at a rate that she hasn't been able to this point. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Professor Gerald Mast from the Political Science Faculty at Carthage about this ferocious fight on the Democratic side for who is going to be the Democratic nominee to confront incumbent President Donald Trump come November. So we've had Iowa, Nevada, New Hampshire, South Carolina is coming up. And at the moment, Bernie Sanders is the front runner, pretty decisively so at the moment. One of the scenarios that I have heard as people have analyzed what has happened thus far is, yes, Bernie Sanders is the front runner, but if you group together all of the people that are more moderate within the party, if the moderate wing of the party were represented by one candidate, this would look very, very different. But instead, you have the moderate element of the Democratic Party, in a sense, dispersed among an array of candidates that sort of fall under that umbrella. And then other analysts say that's really a simplistic way to look at it. So how would you kind of shape this, and how should we interpret the lead that Bernie Sanders has at the moment in this particular respect?
Yeah, I would, you know, hem and haw and qualify it by saying that's sort of true, but it is too simplistic in some ways. It does speak to some things that are real. And so, you know, for instance, we can kind of look at the 2016 race on the Republican side as a very kind of clear analog, where you had a candidate, an insurgent candidate, who had very little, if not any, loyalty to the Republican establishment, enter the field, run against the Republican establishment at least as much as he ran against the Democratic Party, and attracted a kind of a large minority of very energetic supporters, but never really rose above plurality support. And that's Donald Trump, right? In a very large field in which the non-Trump candidates were dividing up the non-Trump support. And they did it long enough, right, to the point where Mr. Trump became the inevitable nominee. And so that may, in fact, be playing out in 2020 on the Democratic side. I guess where I see it, would say it's too simplistic, is that most voters don't have very clear, coherent ideological assessments of the country's policy problems of government or their candidates. And so, I mean, ideology matters to some degree. It's not to be discounted. But people also kind of vote for a variety of less kind of intellectual or rational reasons, right? There's an old saying that people vote not for what they want, but who they are. And so to the extent that a voter identifies more with one candidate on a personal level, you have I like this person. I don't always agree with some of their issues, but I just feel that she's an authentic kind of candidate, right? So authenticity is a factor that matters. And so people talk about lanes, the progressive lane and the moderate lane, so to speak. And that works to a point, but voters occupy the progressive lane or the moderate lane for a variety of reasons, some of which are ideological, but others are more personal, and they can cross over one in either direction for a number of different reasons.
Right. So one thing I've heard spelled out is that I think this was at least officially true in Iowa, that you had – If the simplistic view were true, that you're either for Bernie Sanders or you're for one of these more moderate candidates, then for these moderate candidates, your second choice would never be Bernie. If you're a Buttigieg person, your second choice would be Klobuchar or Warren or Booker or whoever. And in many cases, it wasn't.
Right.
Your first might be Buttigieg, but your second would be Bernie. Or your first would be Bernie,
correct,
and your second would be Buttigieg. And that's that changing lanes thing you were
there
talking
about. There is an assumption that all of Liz Warren's supporters, if they stop supporting Liz Warren, will shift to Sanders because their policy positions are reasonably similar. And I would argue from what I've been able to see that many of them would, but by no means all of them would, right? There would be a significant share of them that would shift to Biden or to Buttigieg or another alternative.
Right. I guess one of the questions that this brings up is one of electability. And it sounds like for many, many Democrats, maybe for most Democrats, that is the pressing issue, is I want our party to nominate somebody who can defeat President Trump. And then, of course, that becomes the million-dollar, a billion-dollar question of who is the most electable?
Right.
What does that even mean in 2020?
Right. The electability factor is never going to go away. It will always be a question that voters are going to be asking themselves. But I guess I would like for people to set aside their very conventional assumptions about what is electable for a moment and take some critical assessment of those things. Certainly President Trump is president, and nobody would have defined him as the most electable candidate. Maybe even Mr. Trump wouldn't have defined himself as that at the very beginning of the nomination process. He's this insurgent outsider. In 2008, very close election, small field, two people in it, but it kind of went down to the wire. Between this young, reasonably inexperienced senator from Illinois, from a demographic group that has never occupied the White House, against former First Lady Senator from New York, firmly ensconced in the Democratic establishment. Barack Obama became president. He wasn't the conventional pick. So it's dangerous to think you have a sense of who the safe candidate is. It requires you to understand exactly what the electorate's going to be, exactly what the electorate's going to want. And on some level, we're engaged in some guesswork there.
Let's kind of talk about the remaining candidates and how they've been doing thus far. We'll have to do this in relatively quick fashion, but we can take a little extra time, I think, with our front runner, Bernie Sanders. I would love to hear from you what you think is the basis of his tremendous success thus far. And also, we've already drawn some intriguing parallels between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Certainly, they are two very, very different people, very different human beings, very different resumes. But there are intriguing parallels in terms of what they are achieving and, in a sense, what they have a way of tapping into. How do you see that relationship as you characterize the nature of Bernie Sanders' success thus far?
Well, I'll start by noting an observation by a historian of politics at Georgetown University, Michael Kazin, an observation that I happen to think is correct. Professor Kazin argues that Bernie Sanders has already won the larger battle here, right? The war for the identity of the Democratic Party. Whether he wins the nomination or not is another question, but what he has successfully done from Kazin and my perspective is he has defined kind of progressivism, right? A real kind of more active government engaged in a project to make the political economy more sustainable ecologically and more equal in terms of the distribution of income and opportunity. He has won that vision, and even if somebody from that so-called moderate lane captures the nomination, the party is moving in that direction. This is especially true when you just look at the level of enthusiasm, right, that is going on at the various events, and some of the largest and most enthusiastic events seem to be those held by Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren. When you look at and break down the support for the various candidates by age, Senator Sanders is drawing the youngest adults, right? And so they actually are quite literally the future of the party. Mm. And so the messages that are resonating with them are the kinds of messages that are likely to continue to resonate as the party moves forward into the future. Last week, CBS News, I believe it was CBS News and YouGov, polling firm, came out with a poll, a huge sample of 10,000 people, relatively small margin of error. And some really interesting things were in that poll. One was asking likely Democratic voters who they felt, which of the candidates in the field most likely would fight for issues that are for fight for people like them. Which candidate would most likely fight for people like them? And there's a real spread, right? The candidate with the most kind of support, right, was Bernie Sanders. 57% of the Democrats in the sample said they felt Bernie Sanders would fight for people like them more than the others. The next, very close to Sanders, was Elizabeth Warren, right? Mm. And then there's this big drop-off all the way down. So Sanders was at 57. I think Warren was at like 55, something like that. And then it drops all the way down to the low 30s, 31, 30, Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden, right? So there's this gap. What does that suggest? To me, it suggests that this kind of progressive vision is the one that is being espoused by Sanders and Warren, is the one that many people feel is reflective of a desire to both understand ordinary Democrats and fight for them. And then if you think about the kind of the rhetorical strategies that are being employed by kind of establishment moderate candidates versus Sanders and Warren, this is playing out quite a bit in the debates, especially last night, is to kind of characterize Senator Sanders as this radical who's out of touch with the larger the larger country, and who, because he self-identifies as a democratic socialist, right, represents something that the country is unlikely to accept. And Senator Sanders' response to that is, what I am proposing is not remotely radical. And it's hard to dismiss his argument. I mean, if we look at some of the polling on positions, so for instance, an example is the free college, tuition-free higher education, public universities and colleges. And some of the candidates, like Mr. Buttigieg and Ms. Klobuchar, have argued that position that Sanders and Warren are taking is like this giveaway, free stuff for people. That this is kind of something that Americans are unlikely to support. And Pew Research Center has actually some data on this very issue, right? And so a week or so ago, the Pew Research Center asked Americans what they think about tuition-free college. And this is what they found. 83% of Democrats and Democratic leaners support it.
Wow.
83% of Democrats support it. Right? So is this a radical idea? Not in the Democratic Party, it's not.
Right.
39% of Republicans and Republican leaders supported it, right? So that's a minority.
But that's a pretty high number.
But 39%. Yeah. 39%. Overall, 63% of all American adults, 63%. So that's not a radical idea. It might be a bad idea, right, in terms of policy. There might be negative consequences that would stem from such a strategy. That's, I mean, another debate. But from a political standpoint, it's not a radical idea. If by radical we mean something that's really unpopular with the American people. So Sanders seems to be, you know, right about that. If you look at, you know, his characterization of climate change as this looming existential threat to civilizations, perhaps the scale of which he's characterizing it is further along than many Americans would agree to, although not necessarily the scientific community. What we see when we ask the public about these kinds of things, again, this is the Pew Research Center's findings of very recent, a couple of weeks ago, they found that the environment, protecting the environment, is now at a level or slightly higher than protecting the economy as a priority.
Wow.
Amongst the public. When it comes to viewing climate change as a top priority, 78% of Democrats say that it's a top priority. That number drops way down to 21% for Republicans. And so climate change is one of those issues for which there's a really big disagreement between the parties. But it's not radical to say that for Democrats, we should, you know, put climate change at the top of near the top of the list of things that we should tackle. When it comes to things like Medicare for All, right? Similar, you have relatively high rates of support within the Democratic Party for it. Off the top of my head, it's somewhere in the 60s. And so that's not a radical idea for Democrats. And heck, we have a Medicare for Americans who are 65 and older. So by definition, we already have this kind of approach to healthcare for a large segment of the population. This is an extension of it to people who are younger than 65. Again, might not be a good idea as a matter of policy, but it's not necessarily a radical one for Democrats. It's much less unpopular for moderates and for Republicans. And so, you know, it might not be a great political strategy moving into the fall, but to characterize it as radical, you know, I mean, not really, not in some ways. In any event, I guess I would say that to the extent that these kinds of positions that Warren and Sanders are pitching, to the extent that there is some possible radical element to them, they seem, based on the evidence, the social survey evidence, to be capable of shifting into a much more conventional perspective. And when it comes to the identity of the party and the character of the party, just having this conversation makes these things much more likely moving forward. And so this is where Kazin, I think, is right, that the dialogue, the discourse that's playing out, right, involves a narrative being pushed by Sanders and Warren that is really resonating and compelling with many Democratic voters.
And in a sense, the tone of the entire party is shifting in a progressive direction, thanks to Mr. Sanders to a large extent.
Correct. So, I mean, if we think about party history, the Democratic Party operated through much of the 20th century on what historians and political scientists call the New Deal Coalition. The New Deal Coalition, built by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, consisting of Northern Democrats, largely clustered in the cities, Southern Democrats throughout the South, Black Americans who have traditionally been Republicans, and progressives in the North who had traditionally been Republicans. So he pulled this coalition together, and that dominated in the 30s, and the 40s, and the 50s, and into the 60s. It began to unravel initially in the 60s when the Democratic Party decided, well, you know, we're going to get behind civil rights because the civil rights movement kind of compelled them to. that created a fracture within the New Deal coalition as Southern Democrats became unhappy with the party's embrace of civil rights. And so in the years that followed, the Republican Party saw an opportunity, the opportunity being to let's convince these Southern Democrats to become Republicans, which was successful, right? Mm. This is Nixon's strategy, Reagan's strategy. When eventually this strategy on the part of the Republican Party kind of came into its own, into its fruition, is in 1980 with Reagan's election. And if you'll remember the term Reagan Democrats, what Reagan did was he pulled a number of Democrats into the party, working class white guys in the Midwest, who were kind of economically liberal, many of them kind of probably union members, but socially kind of conservative. They thought of themselves as traditional Americans. And the conversion of the South from solidly Democratic to solidly Republican. So that moment, right, represents this kind of shift, a conservative era, right? Ronald Reagan ushers in, and success is persuasive. He wins in 1980. He wins a massive landslide in 1984, and in so doing, he is kind of conveying this message to the electorate: it's cool to be conservative, right? And so. The country shifted in a way, including the Democratic Party. So that you have kind of key operatives in the Democratic Party form a group called the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council. One of the architects of that was a guy by the name of Bill Clinton. And the purpose of that organization was to make the Democratic Party more moderate. Right, to move it closer to the center, to make it more business friendly. This is part of what is often referred to as the third way, right? So the third way represents this middle ground between parties on the left, parties on the right. The third way kind of cuts between the two of them, socially more liberal, more moderate to conservative on economic issues. And so a guy like Bill Clinton, Democrat, elected in 92, announces the era of big government is over. That's a Democrat saying that, right?
Yeah.
And so the reinventing government is this big initiative by Clinton and Gore to shrink the size of the federal government, to make it more lean, more efficient, to contract out, to private, right? All kind of consistent with what we think of as conservative philosophy. In the 1970s, Richard Nixon says, we're all Keynesians now, kind of referring to this kind of everybody's bought into the idea that government should spend to stimulate the economy in downturns. That's reversed after the 1980s, in which kind of moderate free trade kinds of economics become kind of this collective commitment. Free trade is Clinton signs off on NAFTA. Mm. He helps usher China into the world community of trading partners, and one of the fallout there is that you get a bunch of kind of social conservatives, but kind of economic liberals on the working class feeling like the Democratic Party has kind of betrayed them in a way, right? They don't particularly like the liberal direction culturally of the Democratic Party on social issues, and they don't particularly see the Democratic Party as working out for working class people. Yeah. Sanders represents a clear shift in that thinking, right? And Warren, both of them are arguing that the Democratic Party went too far to the center and needs to return to its kind of roots in a FDR way as a working class people's party.
Mm. So what their competitors might want to characterize as this radical leap in
socialism,
they're saying is this is a return to our roots. It's really interesting to look at these proposals in those two different lights. I mean, to see them described in those vastly different
right.
ways.
Well, I mean, I think that where Sanders is vulnerable is in his kind of embrace of the term democratic socialism. Socialism being something of an anathema to many Americans. Well, not all Americans. For Democrats, it's not particularly unpopular. Hmm. For independents, it certainly is. And for Republicans, it's even more unpopular. There's variation in terms of its perception by age as well. For young people, it's not particularly frightening at all. Right. Many of them are actually quite fine with the idea of it. For older Americans who grew up in the Cold War era, it's a
a terrible idea, right? Mm. So there's real kind of generational differences. And so by embracing the term, right, I think Sanders is gratuitously taking on hits, self-inflicted harm that he wouldn't necessarily need to do it. But in some ways, he strikes me as a kind of stubborn fellow who doesn't want to back down. If he were to instead kind of push this idea of a new deal, an FDR kind of commitment to government creating opportunities for those for whom their market hasn't created many opportunities, for redistributing the incredible imbalance of wealth and income that has happened, I think he'd have far more appeal.
Right, without that label being attached. Right. Yeah, he's being either stubborn or courageous or some combination of the two.
Right.
So he is the front runner at the moment. By no means is he the inevitable nominee for the presidency, but at the moment he certainly has a decisive lead in terms of delegates. There is a cluster of candidates behind him, among them former Vice President Joe Biden, who of course has performed pretty poorly in these first three races. What kind of challenge confronts Joe Biden now?
Right. So what Biden and his supporters are looking at, I would think, they should if they're not, is 1992. A guy by the name of Bill Clinton captures the nomination. Bill Clinton didn't win a race until Super Tuesday. The first state he won was on Super Tuesday.
Wow.
Did very well on Super Tuesday and used that momentum to kind of sweep the field in the weeks that followed. So, you can be behind going into Super Tuesday and turn things around. And that all starts, I think, with South Carolina. If Vice President Biden is capable of winning South Carolina by a really solid margin, then he can head into Super Tuesday kind of talking about, look, I am the party's future. I'm the one who can reach out to kind of a more diverse group of people, African Americans being a key constituency, and hope to do well in those kinds of states on Super Tuesday that resemble South Carolina. So Alabama goes, Arkansas goes, Tennessee goes. These are states. More moderate ideologically, politically, and the Democratic groups in those states will be more heavily African American. So if he can parlay a win on South Carolina into wins in those states, maybe do very well in Texas, damage control in California, he can emerge out of Super Tuesday with something of a fighting chance.
Interesting. By the way, we don't have time to talk about this very much, but do we know why Joe Biden has such high numbers when it comes to African American voters? I mean, can we attach that strong support for Biden in that group to anything in particular?
Well, let's first note that there seems to be variation within the African American electorate with respect to Mr. Biden. His support is stronger amongst older voters. And so that's true of older Democrats in general, even amongst white voters. So part of it is this is a little bit of conjecture on my part, is familiarity. Mm. He's a fellow who's been around for a very, very long time. And so in some sense, voters feel they know him, right? And when we look at the relationship between voters and politicians, politicians try to instill in voters a sense of trust, a trust based on identity, identify with you, a sense of empathy. This person empathizes with me in a position of qualification. And Mr. Biden, I think, is clearly qualified, right? And nobody's going to argue he's not qualified. Identity, they know him. They're familiar. He's really good, I would argue, at kind of person-to-person politics, much better than he is on the debate stage. Empathy, right? As a member of the Obama administration, right? The first African American president, very, very, very well liked in the African American community. He has that association that works to his advantage. Mm-hmm.
We have these other contenders, of course, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and we have not yet mentioned Michael Bloomberg. To what extent is he a factor in this at all, having not been on a ballot yet, but of right. course spending a lot of money on right. commercials and so on. Is it possible to even know what kind of role he's likely to play, if any?
Well, not with certainty, of course. Again, a lot of guesswork. I'm pretty confident that he'll be a factor. He'll be a factor if for no other reason than the amount of money that he has to spend on this. It's hard to see him having a really strong shot at the nomination for a number of reasons. One, I've kind of already established that the energy in the party seems to be moving in a more progressive direction. Mr. Bloomberg has made a reputation on being a center-oriented fellow, right? A Republican for quite a while. And the very effective critique of Mr. Bloomberg's candidacy offered by Ms. Warren in the last couple of debates, I think, illustrates how easy it is to kind of cast him as this person who doesn't belong in this process, right? For a variety of reasons. He has – there's questions, right, about his relationships with women in his business, the stop and frisk issue in New York City – all of which are kind of red flags for a Democratic electorate that seems to be moving in this progressive direction. Yeah. On the other hand, he has a lot of money. He has a pretty, outside of stop and frisk, a pretty good record at running New York City. The city has improved in a variety of different ways. He seems a very, very competent manager. It's how he's casting himself. So, I mean, you can put together an argument for him. It just seems, in some sense, that this isn't the right political moment within the Democratic Party for him.
Hmm. I did not watch the debate last night, but I understand that it was pretty ferocious
and red and tooth and claw.
Right. And in particular, I know that you were a little dismayed by the way in which some of these candidates who are behind Bernie Sanders were really lashing out in ways that you, I think, feel was ultimately probably counterproductive. But it kind of points to the desperate straits that several of these folks find themselves in right now.
Yeah, I think anxiety levels are super high in all camps, right? But some camps have they're anxious, but can have a reason to feel optimistic. Other camps are anxious and they're holding off the inevitable. And so because there's anxiety levels are high and we're moving, really close to Super Tuesday, they have to do something to shake up the dynamic. It's one thing to say, look, anything can happen. It's true. Anything can happen. But we have data at this point about what voters' intentions are in the states ahead. If you look at the public opinion polls that we have on Super Tuesday states, I mean, Sanders is number one or number two in all of them, right? And so if almost all of them. I think he's tied for third in Oklahoma. If the polls of voters' preferences in these states hold, well then, I mean, it's hard to kind of see a way to kind of dislodge Mr. Sanders from heading into the end process with a plurality or majority of the delegates. And so they've got to do something. They've got to change it up, right? And so it's high risk to be negative and to be critical. But at some point, you just have to ask yourself, what do we have to lose at this point?
Right. I heard on Pod Save America in their analysis of, I think, the not last night's debate, but the debate before that, one of them said, I don't think you can attack yourself to the head of the pack. I mean, it takes more than just claws and attack to do that.
Especially for a candidate like Senator Klobuchar or Mayor Buttigieg, who kind of present themselves as nice people, calm, reasonable coalition builders. To come out kind of as this fiery kind of attack a person kind of seems inconsistent with who they're trying to cast themselves. But all of those candidates are really kind of caught in what in social science we call a prisoner's dilemma, right? That is to say, it works to the advantage of every one of those non-Sanders candidates for the others to drop out. If the others drop out and they stay in, well, then all of a sudden the game has changed and now they've got a legitimate shot. But that's true for every one of them. And so the logic of it being true for every one of them means they all stay in, and that will potentially, right, doom them to the extent we can use the word doom to the Mr. Sanders moving forward.
Right, and they all appear to be very tenacious at the moment. So.
Yes, with I guess the one thing that struck me was Senator Warren's attacks on Sanders. She very cautiously defended Sanders on policy issues and his approach. So she doesn't want to do kind of self-damage to the kind of progressive argument. Where she drew a distinction between herself and Mr. Sanders is in their relative degrees of capability of being, you know, effective at being president. And, you know, I think she makes a compelling case. But the others very much are moving in a very critical direction against Mr. Sanders as a on a personal level, as well as on a kind of a anti-progressive political policy position.
Right. I don't think you're a big fan of these debates, most of them, the way they are kind of structured and formatted and moderated. Especially.
No, I'm not a fan of their structure. I would like to see more conversational approaches. What I would do if I were to create a forum is I would break them up into smaller groups, and I would say, look, I'd seat them at a table. Hmm. I would have one moderator who facilitated a conversation, and I would say, we're going to talk about economic policy tonight. Keep it to economic policy. And then let them talk to each other. Ask them questions, kind of develop positions and so forth. And then you hold another round table conversation about environmental policy. Then you hold one on immigration policy,
gun
foreign
control,
policy, yeah. Right? But you create conversation rather than this. You get a minute 15 seconds to address this enormously complicated issue that I've framed in a way that's hostile to you and has invited others to kind of attack. And so many of the questions I kind of feel are less about illuminating the audience by eliciting kind of a thoughtful policy argument and more directed towards entertaining the audience by encouraging the candidates to attack each other.
It's like somebody who produces The Bachelor on TV is producing these. I mean, trying to engineering it for a certain thing to happen.
It's less firing line and more Jerry Springer, and it really shouldn't be.
Right, absolutely. Well, on that note, we need to draw this conversation to a close. But of course, I think just the nature of this conversation is, you know, kind of underscored the significance of all that is happening, and we'll watch with, of course, great interest what transpires in South Carolina this weekend, right?
Correct,
and
Saturday.
And then, of course, Super Tuesday coming up on
March 3rd.
Yeah, March 3rd. That's going to be huge. 40% of the United States population is represented in those 14 states and the two other races that are part of Super Tuesday. So sometime thereafter, it'll be time to have you back to have another conversation about this. And, of course, ahead of the convention in Milwaukee, wherever we happen to be, that's going to be important, too, and playing out right in our backyard. So I look forward to us having at least a couple more conversations through the course of this really important race.
Well, I did, too, as well.
Dr. Gerald Mast, Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, joining us today here on WGTD. We want to remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And The Morning Show is also available now as a podcast. And you can go to Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or Spotify to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. As a matter of fact, this weekend, now that he has dropped out of the race, I'm going to be rerunning my conversation recorded about a year and a half ago with Andrew Yang, who for a while was a candidate on the Democratic side. So, again, seek out The Morning Show with Greg Berg for the podcast. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring a unique shopping experience in the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha